we, the jury, find you guilty of loving a cheesy, shitty song, sentence you to 2 tickets to paradise. I don't know. It's Guilty Pleasures Night on the Perfect Playlist. Thank you, JD. We are back. You, the listeners, confess your sins. We are here to spill the tea to everybody like a gossipy priest. Are you ready to get cheesy with us tonight, Father JD?
Yes, sir. Bring the Cracker Barrel. I am good. We went out to you and said, what songs are really embarrassing and humiliating? And you gave us the content tonight. You brought the heat, as they say.
Oh, absolutely. This is the Perfect Playlist, guys. Haven't been around a while, but I'm D-Pro, he's JD. We're the same guys we've always been. It's been a minute. Matthew Perry died since we last recorded a podcast. That feels like a decade ago at this point.
It kind of does, actually.
Right?
Sorry for the laughter, but I...
Seriously, that wasn't supposed to be a laughing moment, but okay.
I was laughing with that last line. It does feel like an eternity since we hit record.
It does. And we're tired of just embarrassing ourselves, guys.
Yeah.
We've done it twice now. We've done 2 episodes where we talk about the songs we're embarrassed to love. So we threw it out to you. We threw it out on Facebook and said, what are you humiliated? What's the top of your list of song you're most embarrassed to say that you love? And we took 10 from that list. And a little bit, we're going to go through all 10 of those songs and talk a little bit about the person that nominated it as well. But what I discovered, JD, is that everybody has a different scale of embarrassment. You know, what's embarrassing to you is not embarrassing to me.
Right.
And vice versa.
True. Very true.
And one that really jumped out at me is... This former colleague of ours at work threw out AC/DC, You Shook Me All Night Long.
Oh, no.
For me, that's what I'm most proud of. Like AC/DC, like an Australian rock band. Like,
yeah, sure.
And I feel like that's kind of a low-key flex. That's kind of like just slapping me right in the face.
Depends where they come from, too, on this, right? Are they embarrassed because it's so overplayed that it's cliche and they're being a music elitist?
Probably, yes. Okay,
could be
But I felt like this was a low-key diss at me.
You know? Diss at you. I like that.
Because unless you're like into just like nothing but thrash metal, AC/DC should not be embarrassing. But
yeah, take it personally. I
absolutely have. That's why I'm bringing it up. But there's going to be some stuff here, absolutely, that is embarrassing to everybody. And a few from that are very, very subjective. And we'll get into that as well. So, JD, another thing I wanted to talk to you about, something else that happened since we last were on the air. You were invited to speak at a conference called PodFest.
Yes.
And I was really proud that you did that, mostly because you were right in front of this big, like, Perfect Playlist logo that the great Chris Wichterman designed for us. I was happy to see that.
It was on the big stage, and I got to tell you, there was over, I think, like, there was 2,000 people in attendance at this conference. Perfect Playlist was front and center for almost 2,000 people to see. It was a glorious, D-Pro. It was fun.
And hopefully some of those people are listening to this episode. So
we'll
welcome.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see about that. But another thing that stood out to me was after the conference ended, it turns out you were essentially abducted at like 1 o'clock in the morning during the conference by a woman named Amanda.
Yes. Amanda Russo. She's a gem.
Yes, seems to be to appear on her podcast, Mander's Mindset.
Correct.
So I said, this is great. He's probably going to talk about this podcast glowingly.
Yeah.
So I tuned into the thing and I did the thing where you skip ahead 15 seconds. Uh-huh. I found myself in the middle of one of your sentences saying, well, you know, we don't record that often. I'm not saying it's all his fault, but, you know, he does have 3 kids. So that does, you know, that does play a part.
And your availability, yeah.
And my availability. I felt like the Greyhound was right on top of me in that instance.
Oh, wow. I didn't mean to make it that personal for you. So I just meant that was one of the factors. I didn't really. And then I started. I'm like, why am I going down this path? Who cares? It's just like we didn't record. So we did. You know, we're not that regular. So sorry.
Yeah.
But basically, one thing I learned at that conference, C-Pro, is we're breaking like every single rule in the podcast realm.
That makes it special, right?
Every presentation on that stage was like, don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do that. Sure enough, we do all those things.
Well, we got a little bit of homework to do, but I did find it funny because, like you said, you know, you've been all day, the nerves built up, you're networking, there's a lot of stuff going on, and all of a sudden you're being asked, hey, why don't you have a regular cadence of your podcast? Like, what's going on there?
Yeah. That's like rule number one, by the way, and of course we break it.
Always try, though. We're never giving up, and we haven't been around since August, but we're back. We got a couple episodes in the can, so we're excited to do it. But before we get to the playlist, finally, JD... I have a particular set of skills.
Mm-hmm.
None of those are going to help me out in life in any way. One of them is word jumbles. A word, this, you know, getting a word jumble right is never going to cure cancer, right?
No, that's terrible talent.
I can guess M&M's color just by chewing on them. I can guess the color. That's been proven wrong, yes.
Yeah, you're not good at that.
But another is guessing a song in just a note or two.
Okay.
So I challenge you to come up with a few songs to throw at me and play a little perfect playlist, name that tune.
Yeah. Yes. So Deep Row, we have fun. And I will say this, there is a theme here. The theme of this Name That Tune exercise is songs or artists that are back in the news for a certain reason, right? So
this isn't going to help me because I don't watch the news, but we'll see. We'll see how we do.
Newsworthy or something happened recently with the artist or the song. So
okay, I'm ready.
Here we go. This is the first one.
This is a lot more than one note, and I don't know any of it.
Yeah, I couldn't. The name of the song's in the first couple seconds, so.
Did she say, I know? Is that the name of the song?
No. So,
how about now?
Hook.
Is this not a real singer? It doesn't sound like a real singer. It sounds like a celebrity. It is.
So, this is Sophie Ellis Bextor. Murder on the Dance Floor.
Murder on the Dance Floor. Okay.
Name of the song? Originally out in, I think, like 2001 or something. It was a top 10 hit, I believe. And brought back into, got a second life. We had an episode called Second Life, right?
Yeah.
Got a second life thanks to Saltburn, the movie.
Yes.
That came out, I think, around Christmas time or so.
I heard good things. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, yeah. Good family film. Check it out.
That's what I'm hearing, yeah.
And so that's why I brought it in. But then just a few days ago, it came to light that the guy from the New Radicals wrote this song.
Get out, really?
Yeah. This is his song. This is one of his demos.
That new Radicals album is like one of my favorites from the 90s. It's like it's top to bottom a very good album.
Stand it.
Really?
Yeah, it's just one of those artists I really don't like.
But do you listen to the whole album?
No.
Just that song? Just that to song. Get what you give?
Yeah, I can't deal.
Well, you probably won't like the rest of the album either then, but it's at least well written from a pop perspective.
But yeah, this is one of his demos, and he just happened to like kind of admit that recently. Or at least that came to light, let's just say.
I could see that being the case. So yeah, I could see him
writing. The music world is freaking out by that news. So
very cool.
And this song is now like number two, I think, on Billboard. So all good. Love it.
Maybe I won't bomb this next one.
Love that song. I don't think you're gonna. We're switching to hip hop here, okay? I'm kind of stylish. Lifestyle lavish. Jump in a coupe with no mileage. Here we go, Deep Row. Now, admittedly, you're not a hip-hop guy.
That's true.
Try to wrap your head around this.
Wrap my head around it?
Nice. Okay, any guesses? I'll give you one guess. Go ahead.
Is this Le'Veon Bell?
No, but you're in the right ballpark.
Antonio Brown?
Literally, yes, Antonio Brown.
It does sound... I remember being one of those schmucks.
Oh, totally, man. I'm going to give that to you because you were damn close at that. Le'Veon Bell is an NFL running back. So this is... Antonio Brown, former NFL wide receiver, who about a week or two ago likened the women's NCAA all-time scoring leader, Caitlin Clark, to Mel Gibson in a tweet. He said she looks like Mel Gibson. Like
he's been going down this downward spiral for a couple of years now.
But dude, he released this album that this song is on. Hours after running off the field in that Buccaneers
jet. That's right. He ripped his shirt off and ran off the field. And I mean, that's kind of not a bad idea for publicity stunts or to promote an album.
Or just leaving work on an average day.
Where did Deep Row go? Oh, he left and he dropped a rap album like immediately.
Also, though, he just a few days ago, another thing, it just popped in, right? So I had this in the queue a few days ago. Antonio Brown released more of his texts with Tom Brady, and guess what? Of course.
Tom Booty, as he calls him.
Tom Brady came out looking great again, and Antonio Brown comes out looking like an even bigger POS. Classic Antonio
Really? Brown. I'm going to see that.
Classic AB. So yeah, more just came to light. All right, Deep Row, this is the final one. Okay, here we go, Deep Row.
Oh my God, those are the sultry sounds of Yoko Ono.
100% nailed it. There she is. Oh. 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 Oh.
Once you hear that once, you never forget it. It's like Stairway to Heaven the first time I heard that.
For those that don't know, this is Yoko Ono. I almost said Yokozuna. Yoko Ono.
He would have done better.
I wish I was with Yokozuna right now to hearing this 6 feet under. Anyway, this is Yoko at MoMA. I can't even talk over this.
You can't do it.
She's at MoMA just screaming into a microphone, and it's called like an art show. So, oh, I had to stop that, D-Bro. Wow, I had to stop that. In
you know
tracks.
What? And just because of who she is, she'll get more downloads than this podcast will.
Yes, of course. Well, it was her birthday 2 weeks ago. She's a spry 91. So
she's 91?
Yes, sir.
I don't know, man. I was not expecting that selection of songs you threw at me right there.
No, man. All right, so let's jump in on this one. This is from Anne. Our friend Ann and our other friend Joy. This is Blame It on the Rain by the one and only Milli Vanilli. Oh no.
The most infamous ruse in music history, JD.
Oh, yeah.
Two men, if you're not aware, if you're a little younger than us, two men who ended up just being the face and the bodies, of this act, Milli Vanilli, but actually didn't sing a note on the song or any of the albums.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It is probably one of the most infamous stories in music history, if not one of the darkest as well.
Yeah, I mean, apparently there's a, which I don't have, I don't have the streaming service yet, Paramount Plus, and I'm not at this point now where one thing's going to make me jump, but there is a Milli Vanilli doc on there, and I watched, like, the trailer, and apparently it's all about how these two men were basically the only ones held accountable for this thing.
Yeah, exactly, which is surprising, because obviously, as you know, with any record label, it takes a village, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ann said that people tell me I should be embarrassed by this song, but I don't embarrass very easily.
Yeah, that's another thing. A lot of people came back with, like, I'm embarrassed. Actually, fuck that, I'm not embarrassed. I'm actually proud that I like this song.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of, like, kitschiness to it and campiness and, like I don't know. I don't know how embarrassed you should be to like this song, but, JD, so there are actual singers like Jody Rocco, there's a bunch of
who?
Different.
Jody Lucy Rocco,
Tony Rocco, Linda Rocco, John Davis, and Brad Howe are like the actual singers. So my question to you is, assuming this thing didn't go up in flames like it did, that one performance where they heard the backing track and everything, would you rather be the real singers or the fake singers?
I'd rather be the fake singers.
Yeah, me too.
I want all that shine.
You
want
just
all
get
those.
All the fame. Like, you get the front row at all the 5-star restaurants. You get to the front of the line.
And these guys just dance around. Remember the videos? They dance around like two dopes, just like flopping. Almost like those front of the car dealerships with
those floppy arms.
Inflatables.
And their hair. And, I mean, the one dude basically killed himself.
Definitely
got heavy into drugs.
Yeah.
And I think they may have called it accidental, but I don't know about that.
No, he was an addict. He had a suicide attempt, I think, in like 91 or something after this fame. I think this song came out in 89 or so.
Around that time, yeah.
So around 2 years later, he had a suicide attempt, that gentleman who was, then became addicted to drugs. I think Rob, his name is.
Yep.
And he was found dead in 98.
It's crazy. So, yeah. And, I mean, it, these guys essentially were like the Janet Jackson of the situation. You know, they took all of the blame. You know, the song might have been called Blame It On Us because that's what they did. And they certainly were part of it. But people have done much worse things and gotten less flack than these guys did.
But going back to the embarrassing thing, this strikes me as one of those bands that people would not admit at the time that they liked but secretly loved. And I'm talking guys, girls, it didn't matter. Kids, adults.
There's something about a pop song that's catchy, man. And you don't want to admit it, especially when, like you said, these aforementioned goofs were hopping around on stage. Reckless abandon. But
this song, D-Pro, I mean, let's talk about the content here, the tale they're telling. It's basically a tale of heartache after a girl has left her man, and this is the man, I guess, or the person consoling the man. And this is some of the shittiest advice I've ever heard.
It's pretty bad.
There's zero accountability here. Don't look to ways that you can improve yourself or look at the things that you did wrong in the relationship. Fuck it. Just blame the rain.
It kind of reminds me of that Shaggy song, like, it wasn't me. Just say it wasn't you. Just right. Like, just take zero account. Speaking of accountability, it's kind of ironic that the song's about zero accountability when everybody around them took zero accountability after this whole thing happened. Now, JD, another thing that I want to get to before we forget is at the end of each song, we were going to rank them on a scale of 1 to 10 on an embarrassment scale. Now, everybody...
For us as individuals.
For us as individuals. Yeah. However, I'm going to look at it through this lens. You can do it if you'd like to as well. I'm going to pretend that I'm at a work conference. So a pretty serious professional setting. You're wearing a suit and tie.
Your name tag on?
Yeah, you got your lanyard around your neck. And they go up to and ask you, what do you want your walk-up song to be?
Oh, wow.
This is a little bit different than, okay, what's a song you're embarrassed to like? And you say, whatever, Madonna, Like a Virgin. Oh, yeah. This is different. This is a song that's going to essentially represent you.
So, like, the crowd is waiting on you to walk up, and this song's going to play you to the stage.
Yes.
Okay.
I feel like that's a good barometer to go by to assess how embarrassing a song is. So, given that.
Yeah. One being I'm on full strut. 10, I am, like, my balls
humiliated.
Are, yeah.
Yeah. So in that way, I'd give this I'm giving it a 7, this one.
I would stick with a 7 on the embarrassometer there. Yeah, I would say this is a 7. I agree with you on that. It feels right.
Cool.
Right to me. All right, a song with, if you look through the lyrics, very serious, very, very manly, very powerful. But the movie it was attached to was about, like, I don't know, a bunch of kids in a bar. So St. Elmo's Fire from John Parr. Bro, this is absolute 80s cheddar cheese, and cheese, if you don't know, stinks the longer it's left to mature. I don't enjoy this song.
I mean, I was a kid when this came out, and this was cheesy to me then.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Everything about it, like the, you know, the, just like the way the vocals are processed and the freaking horns. Listen.
Right there.
Toot, 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 toot. And throughout the whole thing, the synthesizer and the lyrics and the themes and, like, the big chorus, everything about it is super 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
And my buddy Greg is the one who wrote, who nominated this. So he's a little older than us, which I think is important to frame, right?
Yeah.
Because when I'm a kid and I listen to this, I'm not as embarrassed when I like it because I'm a kid. But when you're, like, a teenager and you're listening to this, it's seen a little differently. You're much more...
You're
reluctant to admit that you like this song if you're like a 17-year-old kid.
Yeah, no, I think at that point you're becoming a discerning young adult. You just want to go with what's cool or what your friends are listening to. I don't think you're going to John Parr.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. I mean, but Greg's a really fascinating guy, a great writer. And once I told him that I'm a writer too and we can share thoughts and ideas, he will randomly just, like, send me poems, like, in text.
Really?
He's kind of, it's kind of like
romantic.
Yes, it is a little bit. But it's kind of like being friends with Leaping Lanny Poffo. It's really fun. But so he wrote this.
Hear ye.
He wrote this about the song. The video, It's Always Raining, Low is stunningly beautiful. First words of the song, growing up, every teenager can relate. The brat pack's empty, depressing gaze, so young, yet nothing to live for. I'm like, this is great. Like, he should write trailer, like, he should write copy for trailers, you know?
I'm glad he brought in the brat pack, because that was my lead into this song and how the movie is completely incongruous with this song. Like, this song was written, I think, for a guy who was... taking a wheelchair across Canada to raise money for what? Something? Wheelchairs? I don't know.
Yes. It's for the underprivileged, yes.
Yeah, I don't know. But that was the intent. And then John Parr is like, oh, wait a minute. What's this movie about? Oh, snap. Well, we're releasing it anyway. Because, I mean, I got to be honest with you. The movie studios at this time, they realized that having a big, strong hit like Footloose or Flashdance, What a Feeling, would put that song in constant rotation and put asses in seats at the box office to boost the movie, right?
Yeah.
So it's a logical business move to have a bold song like this representing your movie.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense in that way. But can we talk about the song that he did later?
Sure.
Many years later, because if there was a way that he can trump this from an embarrassment perspective, it is this song that I honestly thought was... a joke, like a Weird Al version of this song. Not Weird Al, but like done in that vein. And apparently it wasn't. So many years later, when the football quarterback Tim Tebow was getting popular in the Broncos, and there was Tim Tebow Nation, it was a craze about this guy. John Parr decided, let me get back in the charts by writing a second version of this song about this motherfucker.
Here it is.
And here it is. Tim Tebow's Fire.
Gotta keep your eye on the ball.
Keep your eye on the ball. Yeah.
The lyrics are terrible.
Make it fly.
Make it fly.
Give it everything. Give your all.
Oh, this guy's clearly never seen Tim Tebow throw.
As he's aged, John Parr sounds like the Real Men of Genius guy. Remember that?
Yes, Real Men of Genius. The graphic for this says, the classic anthem, St. Elmo's Fire, rewritten and re-recorded by John Parr for America's iconic quarterback, Tim Tebow. And does he, like, just start screaming, Tim Tebow's Fire?
He does. We're almost there, by the way.
What's he saying here? Oh, God.
This line is the worst. It's coming up. All I need is my Bronco team. That actually made it into the final version of the song.
Oh, God, this is gross. I got the ick real bad after hearing that. Ooh, it's been 12 years, and that wasn't long enough.
What an enormous pile of shit this song is.
Hey, can we move on? Oh, wait, hang on. We have to do the embarrassing...
I give it a 9.
For walking out in a corporate presentation, I'm going to say so many just buttoned-up whites think this is cool still. So I'm going to go down to 5.
Oh, wow.
On the embarrassment.
That's quite a discrepancy.
Yeah. But I got you. I hear you on the 9.
It's all subjective, right? Yeah. I mean, I would feel embarrassed to have this as my theme.
Yeah. But if I was walking out in a corporate presentation, yeah, I think...
Okay, JD, what about Tim Tebow's Fire? Does that change? Geez.
Oh, that kicks me up to a 9.9. All right, let's get to the next one. He's still screaming Tim Tebow's Fire on me.
Do we have to do this next one? Because this is really bad.
Yeah, this sure is. What the hell's going on here, D-Bro?
See, I'm so... As much as I want to hate this song, I absolutely can't.
Yeah, this is the Adams Family Groove by MC Hammer, who dropped the MC right around this time in 1991.
That's how you know things are going well, when you change your name.
Yeah, but it was enough to make this a top 10 hit. Just his name and that movie and this song.
It's a catchy tune. It was a popular movie.
Yeah.
You know, so everything was still kind of working, but... it wasn't going to last for long. Our buddy Anthony, who's a frequent listener of the show, we appreciate Anthony.
I love Anthony, yeah.
Sent this in, which made me laugh. It's MC Hammer, the tail end of his popularity. My God, was it ever. Much like Vanilla Ice, he's synonymous with turning hip-hop into pop, ignoring the fact that Hammer once put a hit out on guys from third base. Who are those guys? It's hard to rock a theme song proudly. I mean, who wants to be in the car with D-Pro when he's cranking Cindy Fee? I had no idea who Cindy Fee was. I assured him I didn't. Then I... found out afterwards he's the one who sings the Golden Girls theme song.
Nice.
So, point well made, Anthony.
Yeah, and he likes the staccato right here. Like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's why, like, with, you know, modern hip-hop, you know, a lot of people think it's trash. I think they're mostly right. But the band Migos, this trio, or at least they used to be, they're very popular, and their music was very popular for a short time a couple years back. And I'm like, what is it about those guys? So that's what I like to do. If I can't understand something, I'm like, I try to dissect it. What do people see? And they all rap like that. They rap the same way. They go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like their lines.
There's something aesthetically pleasing about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like another instrument.
So it's like their voices in his...
Exactly. Bingo, man.
Yeah, we're saying the same thing here, bro.
So apparently, I mean, MC Hammer, as we're kind of alluding to, eventually lost like most of his money due to extreme personal expenditures for several years in the 90s. He had $70 million at the peak of his career. He had 17 luxury cars, a private jet. Motherfucker had 2 helicopters. Imagine being so rolling in money, you need a spare helicopter.
This album is actually on 1991's Too Legit to Quit. And the budget for the Too Legit to Quit video alone had to be astronomical. It had like Deion Sanders and got like all these celebrities and whatnot in it. You got to pay those people, right? So
yeah,
this guy is obviously spending money out the ass. So
I think it would be interesting if we did like a study or at least a podcast on the second album budget, you know, after the first album, like Oasis or definitely maybe to, you know, what's the story? Like there's like this big production change that happens from one to two.
And so he actually put this on Too Legit to Quit, like on as an album track, which is so weird to me.
The Addams Family theme song. Yeah. It's very
on the back
strange.
End of the album. Isn't
very bizarre to do that.
But his real name is Stanley Kirk Burrell. I didn't know that.
Why don't you just go with that as your... That's a good rap name too, right? Not.
Yeah. Oh, you dropped a not joke in 2024. I like it.
Well, you know, we bring that back once in a while. His first album, Please Hammer Don't Hurt Him, which is iconic in my mind only because it was the first album I ever owned. Mm. And I tried so hard, as we all did when we got albums, to get into like all the other tracks. It was like being in a bad relationship and just trying to make it work. But... Dude, the album was so freaking wholesome. You know, it had songs like Pray and Help the Children, yet another track called She's Soft and Wet.
That's Why We Pray. I remember that one. Let's peel this back here. The Addams Family, their song, iconic, right? There's pieces of that here mixed in, all good. But in 91, someone said this Addams Family movie that we're making really needs a catchy theme song because absolutely no one can remember how the original theme went. That's probably somewhat what someone said in those record label meeting rooms. You know what I mean? And then this was made for some strange reason.
I don't know the answer to this, but I wonder if this or the Vanilla Ice Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme came first. Because very similar ideas.
Good question. Go Ninja Go. So in 91, this was a top 10 hit, as I mentioned up top. So if you're a radio station, what on earth do you play on the heels of this song? How do you transition from this song to... I don't know, Celine Dion or whatever the hell was out at the time. I don't know.
It's just so kitschy, right? JD, what number would you give this song?
If I had to walk out to this as my theme song, I'd give it a good 9.
Oh, this is a 10 for me.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
I'm going full 10.
I was being cute.
Yeah.
10. Hey, dude, what's the line? Kick and they slap a friend. The kick and they slap a friend. The Addams Family. Who puts that lyric into a chorus?
You know me with lyrics.
What's the deal with that?
That line annoys me every time I hear it. Not that I hear it a lot, because I haven't heard this song in like 25 years or something, but kick and they slap a friend. There's nothing else that could fit there, really?
On our crowdsourced Guilty Pleasure playlist, someone actually likes Pink's song. This R&B effort from 2000, this is There You Go.
Please don't come around, talk about that you love me. Cause that love just for me. I don't wanna hear that you adore me. And I know that all you're doing is running your mind games. Don't you know that game beats game? So your best bet is to be straight with me. So you say you wanna talk, let's talk. If you won't talk, I'll walk. Yeah, it's like that. I got a new man, he's waiting out back now. What?
Oh yeah, D-Pro, your friend Christina. How do you say your last name? Dilks?
Dilks.
There you go.
Christina, by the way, a little trivia. The only person that I met in college that I stayed in touch with.
Oh, cool.
And like, hey, there's a reason that I stayed in touch with her, because she listens to great music like this. But I'm kind of kidding, but Christina's awesome. So her feedback was, of all the songs that Pink made as singles, this is the bottom feeder. It's so late 90s, early 2000s. Big perhaps time. The worst in the chorus, she says, and we're talking about bad lyrics, this is a terrible one. Sometimes it bees like that.
Yeah, buzz.
But that's not how, like, see, this is the influence of the record company, for sure, or the producer.
Big time.
There's absolutely no way. I mean, this isn't really her. This is basically a Destiny's Child song.
Yeah, essentially.
It doesn't really sound like her. And I'm a stand for Pink. I really like Pink and what she represents. And, you know, her shows are great, and she puts on a great show, and she's endured and everything like that.
Right, but that's a completely different lane than this. This was... For if it wasn't clear, this is Pink's debut solo. I can't get that out. And obviously, they're trying to capitalize on the Destiny's Child era of music and production. This reminds me a lot of sonically, a lot of Bills, that song,
yes,
Destiny's Child.
Very much so, yeah.
Bills, can you pay my bills, right? Great bridge, though, right here.
Love bridge.
Good bridge. It goes out really strong, too. So Pink, you know, starting out her career, coming off a group or something like that, she was in like an R&B trio. and they really pushed her. L.A. Reid and them pushed her to a solo contract in terms of this capitalizing of that late 90s R&B feel. And, you know, like, let her get that street attitude. And you hear in the verses here some of the tougher language. It's just very different than who we know her as today.
Yeah, no, I know. And she's just, I don't know. I've always been a fan of her, and I'm glad she became the artist who she really was meant to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's endured, man. She's had a lot of hit singles. Do you remember that time where I stood up for her at a lunch?
No.
You were at the lunch?
Hit me with it.
It was me, you, and Drew. And, like, somebody mentioned her, like, as a punchline, and I'm like...
Oh, is this after golf?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, time. I do remember
like,
it. Yeah.
I'm like, no, Pink's, like, fucking good, man. She's, like, really good. And I didn't feel like I was defending, like, Kesha or something. I'm like, this is, like, a legitimate artist. Like, she's really good.
One of the highest grossing tours in the world.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm defending Pink. Okay, that's fine. But if you've seen her, I mean, she's a mom, and she's had all these hits, and yeah. She does a freaking high wire act at her concerts. And I really want to get tickets to a Pink concert, JD, after this song.
But she really said, in terms of this album, that she wasn't in full control. The label was. It was really left up to the producers and the record company to mold her into this artist and mold these songs and... but blossomed into who she is now, and obviously very, very different than who we just heard right there. But you hear it in the outro there, D-Pro, in terms of, like, what's to come. The outro vocally, so strong on that song. So she's kind of giving you a little taste of what's coming next from Pink.
I like any artist who can sing different types of music. If you see, like, Post Malone doing, like
Nirvana,
like country songs, he can do anything. I'm becoming a fan of him because of that.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. Did you know how Pink got her name, by the way?
I don't.
Okay. So she changed her name formally to Pink after Steve Buscemi's character in Reservoir Dogs, Mr. Pink.
Really? That's wild.
I don't tip.
And I think Alicia is her original name.
Bye, Alicia. So we're moving on.
Okay, Felicia.
Yeah. Let's get funky here. The 11th single by Duran Duran, and it was only 1984. This is The Reflex. You got too far this time,
but I'm dancing on the Valentine. So, JD, you're a big Duran Duran stan. I know that. I know you're a big fan. I really enjoy Duran Duran, but what the fuck are these lyrics? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Simon Le Bon even said it himself. He's like, because everyone asks him what this means, and like, because some people take an angle that you take, and that's like, this is absolutely ridiculous. What does any of this mean? And then some other people take it, oh, they're so complex and artsy. He finds this song completely ridiculous lyrically, and he won't explain what it is. He won't ever say what it is. My favorite interpretation of this, like, many have theorized that it might be about a member of the band, maybe the keyboard player, or someone thinks it's about Simon writing to his ego while he forgets lyrics when he's performing, like he's kind of torturing himself a little, like don't lose it kind of thing. But my personal favorites, The Reflex is a gag reflex, singing about a gag reflex or not having one.
That's pretty literal.
And then another personal favorite of mine is unwanted erection.
That is a reflex that happens specifically during massages, JD.
Oh, yeah. Or if you're growing up, I was just talking about this with my wife, like how in like high school and whatnot, you know, coming of age, kind of eighth grade or whatever, like you'd just be in class in like algebra and then you just randomly just happen. That'd be your reflex. But and then you're like, I can't get up. I can't stand up right now.
We've all been in a position where we were erect.
Yeah.
And we knew we're going to have to stand up in the next 10 minutes.
Right.
What do you think of?
Right. Something's got to
happen. Maybe think
here.
Of this song. This song would get me down pretty quick. But, you know, honestly, JD, this song is proof, and I've said this a few times on this pod, but that a melody and, like, feel are, like, miles more important than the lyrical content of a song. It means so much. He could be singing, God, he could be reading the phone book, and this song would have been a hit.
And so this song came to us from our buddy Joey, and it's for those reasons that you just said. Like, no, he said, like, it's just no matter where he would be, if this song came on, he'd be compelled to get up and dance to it like no one's watching, just because it's the way it makes him feel.
Yeah. And our buddy Jim G also, he put it pretty well. He said there's a lot of music that he likes now but he didn't like it, quote unquote, then because of peer pressure. You know, the perception is too soft, it's girly.
Yeah.
You know?
Jim's line also in that text to us resonated with me when he said, when you don't have to be defined by your music tastes, it's completely liberating. And I think you and I haven't had this issue throughout our lives. When you and I connected as friends, I think this was one of our common things. Like, we're not embarrassed to say we like what we like.
Absolutely.
You know, and never have been.
I'm sure there's still a couple of songs I wouldn't tell you that I listen to, but it's very, it's there's not a lot of territory.
Send
there.
In the clowns.
I really like, I remember it kind of reminds me when I had the guitar teacher, Ray, who was the greatest guy. And we were talking about how you should be so open-minded as a musician and a songwriter. And you should listen to everything. I'm like, yeah, man. Like, I have like Mariah Carey's Dream Lover, like on constant rotation. And he's like, let's not go that far.
Hold the phone, weirdo. But let's get back to the song for a second. This does take me back to those early days of watching MTV. Seeing the music video, just being in awe of everything that was on the TV in front of us after school. And definitely a catchy pop tune. It checks the boxes for being a great top 40 song in the 80s. Cheesy lyrics, overproduced, group of good-looking guys or girls to sell the visual aspect. This song, this band, it's got it all in that regard.
Absolutely. So, JD, we got to go back one step. And we didn't give Pink a rating.
Oh, snappy balls. If I were to walk out to a corporate introduction with this song playing, the Pink song, there you go. I would give that maybe a 5.
I gave it a 3.
Yeah, it feels...
Mostly because it's colored by, pardon
the pun. I'm being generous, too.
Pink, but yeah, because I colored by my kind of fandom for her, but yeah, I'd give it a pretty low rating.
Yep. Okay, what about The Reflex walking out, you know, now here to talk about our audit methodology. Here's da-da-da-da, The Reflex. What do you think?
This was probably the hardest one for me to answer because Duran Duran is so kind of widely accepted. Like once you, even if it's a cheesy song, they're accepted as this band that is loved pretty universally.
Yeah.
So I gave them a 4 because of that.
Okay.
I didn't give it a high number.
Yeah, I would say it's just too bouncy, so I would put it up to 6 for me in
because
a corporate
of the
song.
Bounciness. Yeah, sure, da, I get that.
Da, 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 da. All right, let's make a hard left here. Yes, still staying in the 80s with you. 1983. This was Allison, our buddy Allison. Shout at the Devil, Motley Crue. Definitely became one of Motley Crue's more popular songs and a fan favorite for sure.
So, dude, we talked a lot about, even offline, how everyone has a different barometer for embarrassing.
Yeah.
I feel like if you're like a real bro, like Motley Crue isn't embarrassing like on any level. But if you've got like a nice job and self-respect, it might be.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you're right. That's a funny way to put it. Yeah, just that, and especially now, these guys are an absolute mess. So... I don't know if you've seen any clips of Vince Neil performing.
Thank God, no.
Singing.
I've seen photos. He looks like a grandma. Like, that. You get to a certain point.
He looks like, what's the, on Rudolph, the big indomitable
yes,
snowman?
Yes, I saw that, yes.
He looks like that, and he sings. He's just like, bah, 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 bah. You have to see. I'll send you a clip. But they're a mess right now. They're playing with backing tracks and the whole thing. It's just such a sellout. And so maybe from that perspective, too, it's like embarrassing to say that you like them now. But
see, I don't know. I don't look at it through that lens. Okay. I mean, fair point.
As a music fan, I'm saying.
Yeah, as a music fan, yeah, that makes sense. But just like on the surface, I think this is an act that I think self-respecting women are more likely to find embarrassing than us.
Yeah.
Right?
There's like a boatload of misogyny with these guys, and they're just dripping with posturing and gimmick.
But I know, JD, I know you're not a huge fan. But you've been to some of their shows.
Oh, it's some of the best times I've ever had in my life.
I kind of feel like this is the only thing I have over you as a music fan. That I'm not a Motley Crue fan and you are. Like, I have all sorts of, like, the Mariah Carey stuff and Aerosmith. Like, my fandoms are pretty embarrassing. But you being into, like, Motley Crue is the only thing that I think, when I go to bed at night, I think, at least I'm not a Motley Crue fan.
Yeah, I will take that one on the chin. I grew up just idolizing these guys in various ways, you know. But they used to do this thing called Crew Fest, and there was no festival to it. It was like
a concert.
Yeah, it was like the bass player from like Tesla or something, like in the parking lot with an opening band from like 3 to 3:45, and then you go inside, and then it's like these just shitty turn of the century acts like Papa Roach or
Sum
something,
41 maybe,
or Godsmack opening for Motley Crue. And it was called Crew Fest. But, dude, we went, and we knew they were getting worse and worse. Each time we'd comment, and my one friend who's way into music punched out. He's like, I am out of here. I am not going back to this thing. But it's such a freak show. The people that come out and still believe that they are part of this army, this Motley Crue themselves, like, wow.
That's part of what you're paying for, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And they toured with Poison, too. So imagine the Bret Michaels crowd plus this. Woof. What a sloppy ass sandwich that was, my friend.
So I was never into Crew, and I think I know why.
Yeah.
I have a theory, and I've been thinking about this a lot this week. I'm figuring out a lot about myself, that I was into the Aerosmiths of the world. So people would be like, well, nobody's actually asked this, but I asked myself, why am I into Aerosmith but not into bands like Motley Crue? Because Crew
Aerosmith
sing,
put Crew on the map.
But it's because Aerosmith were singing songs when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, like Crying, Amazing, Angel, singing one-on-one love songs. They wanted to be with one song, with one person. Whereas a lot of like the girls, you know, Motley Crue was about like droves of girls. And like, I didn't connect with that. Like I was a nerd who just wanted to be with one person. That was it. My wife would be happy.
That is
to
the definition of a nerd.
My wife would be happy to hear this, but yeah, that's just who I was. And I think that's why I never connected it while some others did. So JD, what would you rate this song? Scale of 1 to 10.
If I'm walking out in a corporate arena, I put it at maybe a 3.
I gave it a 2.
Yeah. It feels
pretty
like,
low.
Like you're trying to be like a middle-aged badass.
A little too tough. Yeah. That's the only embarrassing part of it is like, this guy thinks who the fuck he is.
With his acid wash jeans coming out here.
With his like LinkedIn profile without a picture. Oh, God. Talk about a left turn, yeah.
This is a very long walk up here. But two of our peeps put this forth. My friend Larray Cisco, excellent musician. Your friend George put this forward from 1999. Celine Dion and That's the Way It Is.
Pretty good. By the way, that was terrible. That's solid.
I can read your mind, and I know your story. I see what you're going through. Yeah.
This sounds like the Backstreet Boys song.
Right? Yeah.
By the way, it's my cousin Greg now, my friend George, by the way.
Oh, whatever.
So my cousin Greg, which makes it funnier because my cousin Greg, a few years younger than me, was always like, he grew up and he had like the baseball hat on backwards, like the starter jacket and like, you know, like the hood friends, you know, like that's kind of who he was. So it's really funny to see that he's come to this point in his life. He flat out just thinks it's odd for a middle-aged man to be intentionally listening to Celine Dion. I got to agree. Celine's become a punchline.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Especially after the Titanic song.
Yep.
But, it's just so funny.
But before you go on, I want to give Larray's comments here. He's a good musician, Larray. I do look up to him in that regard. But he says, you know, man, my music brain does this thing where a song could be 90% nonsense, but that 10% is what gets me to listen to the song 500 times in a row, like this one. And, you know, this one, like, the verses are but it's got that killer chorus for him. And the melody of like love comes to those that believe it, like that really is.
It's a good hook, man.
Him.
Yeah,
like it dips into that little bit of minor thing, and so as the music nerd, it just hits him in the feels. And we're commiserating on the way that she pronounces stuff, Celine Dion.
Oh yeah,
like love is like lerve.
Yeah, the French Canadian
lerve
going on there. Yeah,
and the her S's too. She shushes her S's at the end. The way it is.
Is.
Yes. You can't.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I think we've waited long enough. Can we talk about the ridiculous age gap between Celine and her dead husband?
Oh, yeah. Dude, yeah, that's monstrous, right?
I'm sorry. I'm a big believer in love is love. However, it's just creepy. She was 12 and he was 36. Sorry, 38 when they first met.
Oh, like 38.
That's like dating one of your kids' friends. It's just weird. And he started dating when she was 19 and he was 45. Like, we're in our mid-40s. Like, can you imagine dating a teenager?
Yeah, I think my issue with it isn't so much the two-decade age gap. It's more the when it started.
Well, sure. If you're 40 and you meet a 60-year-old, that's different than when you're into teenager and meeting a freaking 40-something-year-old.
That 12?
Is wild. Absolutely. Yeah, a 12-year-old. I'm sorry. Anybody, when I'm an adult, I meet when they're 12, we're never going to date. Sorry, that's never going to happen. But I went to Reddit because I love going to Reddit about things like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And this person, Sex and Liquor is their handle.
Oh, jeez.
I think it's pretty clear that she was groomed.
That's a common thought.
Exactly. Doesn't she also have some sort of replica mold of his hand that she had made so she can occasionally hold his hand still even though he's dead?
Oh, that's creepy.
I mean, I'm not trying to badmouth Celine Dion or anything, but I think most people can agree that that's kind of objectively weird. Then there's an edit.
What else is she doing with that hand, bro?
There's an edit. Since I keep getting lots of comments of it's not weird, I didn't mean to say it's weird to have a mold of a dead spouse's or family member's hand if that's how one chooses to grieve. And it's an expression of love. Like, you didn't have to walk that back. It is weird.
No, you're good, bro. Yeah. Good with that upfront statement. But think about the song here, though, Deep Bro. Not to shift off your creepiness of Celine.
We're coming back to it.
And Renee. Please do. I can't help but think of the message here, almost like Blame It on the Rain. It's like, keep your head up, loser. Someone is bound to put up with your baggage and love you.
I've never actually listened to the lyrics of this song.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever have.
It's like, don't give up on love, basically. Hang in there, you sad, pathetic Ben and Jerry's eating loser. It's going to come around.
It's the way it is, you fat piece of shit.
It's coming to you. Just a few more of these to go, I swear to you.
Oh, please.
Okay?
Oh, please.
Just a few more. We're very far along here. We're with you. We're with you. Thank you so much for hanging in there. And this one is John Cicada's Just Another Day from 1992. Our buddy Christian Murillo, who also goes by Andy primarily.
He does.
Let's talk about the two-name thing in a second.
Yeah, we got to do that.
But here's Juan Cicada.
Oh. This is my aforementioned cousin-in-law, Andy, who nobody knew, or at least my wife didn't know, that his name was actually Christian until she was like 35. Because this happens.
It's not even close. It's not like John Jack or, you know, even that. I don't know.
Andy's his middle name.
Oh.
Yeah. And there was another Chris who was born around that time. So
that's why.
But still, there's a lot of deception that happens in my wife's family with stuff like this. There's pretty much everybody goes by their middle name, and you don't find out about it until years later.
I don't know Spanish, but I know in Italian they call it like Lino, like in honor of little in Italian. Like, so my father's name is Nick, and his other cousin is Nicoline, like little Nick, you know? So they didn't do like Cristolino?
They do that as a term of endearment.
Okay.
Like my wife Sonia and her mother will call her Sonita term of endearment.
Okay.
But it kind of means little Sonia, but not. It's hard to explain. It's not a direct translation.
What is creepy husband? Did they ever drop that on you too?
I am a creepy husband.
They call
husband.
You that? Instead of Joe?
But my
fucking weirdo.
My cousin-in-law, Andy, he's kind of a John Cicada lookalike.
Yeah, and I can see that. I'm looking at John right now.
He chose this song. Mm. So I asked him for his feedback, and he's like, I find that this is kind of the epitome of like cheesy early 90s pop ballad. The video is what really sealed it for him and me. It's him on the beach with like wind blowing open his shirt. But Andy ultimately, at the time in his life that this was, he wanted to be John Cicada. This guy was a sexy beast, John Cicada. And I think that's what makes it embarrassing. If there's like a Ricky Martin or like a John Cicada or Enrique Iglesias, the whole like, you know, Latin invasion, you couldn't say that you like those guys. Like they were too sexy to like as a guy.
And plus, like, what genre of music is this? It's not really Latin.
No.
It's not really pop. It's like something. But it's not Light FM either.
No. It's too close to Light FM.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm talking at the time.
Yeah, for sure.
It's too bold. So it's adult contemporary music, like PLJ music, but it's not, that's not a genre.
You're right. I mean, this song came out in a totally like schizophrenic time in for music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gangster rap was becoming big like in the early 90s.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Freaking Nevermind had just come out a year before. But there was still somehow room for this.
Yeah.
On the pop charts, which I is kind of crazy.
A great point. But now songs like this are seen as like supermarket or pharmacy songs.
Oh, the best songs get played there.
Absolutely.
That's when the only shopping, place you're going to hear them.
Completely. It's like I always say, where there's a Rite Aid, there's Roxette.
You know what else I didn't? I have kind of a confession here, JD.
Yeah.
I did not know that John Cicada had done some writing on another prominent artist's work, an artist that I am actually kind of a fan of.
Would that be Ricky Martin? Because he absolutely did.
No. Gloria Estefan.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know what it is. It's something chemical in my brain, but Gloria Estefan's ballads, I cannot turn them off. I'm talking Anything For You, Here We Are, Don't Want to Lose You Now. Like, I just love those songs.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Interesting admission there.
I hate the dancey stuff, like Rhythm's Gonna Get You and Conga, but love the ballads.
But yeah, Mr. Cicada also went on to write for Ricky Martin, as I mentioned, and J-Lo, which I found very interesting.
Right.
But I mean, the guy must be swimming like Scrooge McDuck in money after all that. Just a big pool full of pesos.
Yeah.
Wow.
As he should.
All right. But yeah, I mean, this guy's got huevos vocally.
He's good. He's very, and Enrique Iglesias falls into the same kind of category. Very dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, the song's very like melancholic, right? Again, music nerd hat on. It's in that minor key. It's got that kind of like longing to it. That melodramatic despair to the lyrics and stuff too. And his voice is perfect for it.
But you need, honestly, if you're going to sing a song like this, put your heart into it.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in
that. Put your huevos into it.
Put your huevos in your pelotas.
Yes.
Right into it.
See. But we were talking about the, the like whole like supermarket store hearing songs like this again, just constantly. There's employees of a British supermarket chain who recently put a study forth, or they surveyed rather, and some of the songs that they said they hear on repeat that absolutely drive them insane, you know, are Where Have All the Cowboys Gone by Paula Cole.
Yeah.
You know that song.
Yeah, that's definitely a grocery store song.
Believe by Cher.
Oof,
is another one where they hear that. And then, Joe, I hate to say, but your boys Aerosmith, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. That's another one overplayed.
I'm not a fan of that track. Yeah.
Just overplayed, probably. The other ones are more egregious, I think, in terms of hook.
Yeah.
But, geez. All right, so we got to back up again. So on a scale of 1 to 10, Celine Dion, That's the Way It Is.
Yeah, we keep forgetting. I gave it a 10.
Yeah, I would give it a 10 as well. That is completely embarrassing.
To come out to this song
walking
song? There's I'm here. No, you're going to have to listen to me, and that's the way it is.
Okay. Just another day, 1 to 10. That's your walkout song. How embarrassed are you?
I give it a 6.
A 6 feels right to me, too.
Yeah.
I might knock that down to a 5 just because it's...
It's got a good groove to it, at least.
It's not
a good
corny
feel.
Or bright.
Yeah.
You know? So I might knock it down to a 5.
There's no synthesizer in it. So, yeah, that's fair. But speaking of synthesizers, they're coming very quickly.
Ooh, don't mind that car. Got to go to Advanced Auto Parts. But then again, he might end up hitting on the front person at the front desk. This creep.
Who, me?
No, Billy Ocean.
Oh, Billy Ocean. Sure. Well, he's entitled. He's written some great songs.
Super horny and willing to drive on this song.
Billy Ocean's Get Out of My Dreams. Get into my car. I don't think I've ever heard this part of the song.
All right, let's just talk.
This is the true embodiment. When I think of 80s music, this is what I think of. This is one of the first songs I think of.
Oh, yeah. This is like Charming Cheddar.
Yeah. Like, this feels like... It feels like Nirvana's Nevermind was written in response to this song. Because Kurt Cobain hated pop music like this so much. But, Billy... It was so good at writing, like, the perfect pop song for me.
Mm.
Like the verse, the pre-chorus, the chorus, it all soars. It all works.
But that's interesting musically, to your point about Nirvana, because we're talking, this is 1988 when this song came out. Number one hit for Billy Ocean. Brought to us by your sister, by the way. Your sister
and by the way, she was very quick to say she wasn't embarrassed. My sister, there's no shame in her game, did not give a fuck.
But around this time in 1988, you're seeing the emergence in terms of the pop charts of the REMs of the world, U2, right? So you're seeing like a bit of a shift towards more guitar-oriented pop music.
Yep.
And then there's this.
I mean, the time was running out on music like this. So now I can look back on it lovingly and be like, this was great. It still reminds me of the, for me, very underrated 80s film License to Drive, which it was featured in at the very end. It always reminds me of that. Corey Haim, Corey Feldman moment. A very, very young and really unknown Heather Graham starred in the movie. Which, by the way, she was the female lead and spent 90% of the movie in the trunk of a car. Because she went out with Corey Haim, failed his driving test, still stole his father's Cadillac to take her out on a date. She gets drunk, passes out in the trunk of a car. One of the most nonsensical things that ever happened in film, he gets pulled over by a cop who opens the trunk and sees a girl in the trunk of the car and then gets called away to another assignment and leaves.
Wow.
Can you imagine that happening?
That's, way before body cams.
Yeah, he's like, you just got lucky, punk, and drives away. I mean, come on now.
But yeah, this song, though, if you look at it now, you look at the lyrics on paper, if you are a Gen whatever, and you look at this, it's like a Predator's favorite song. It's basically like, get into my trunk. I mean,
My Trunk was the original title of the song.
But look at Billy Ocean. I mean, he's like, if you ever seen a picture of him, he's like, he can get away with that. He's the most, like, utterly unthreatening persona visually.
He's a charming looking individual. And
he just looks like your uncle.
If you're going to get somebody to jump into your car, this is the type of song that would do it. Yeah, you know,
this guy just wants to put you in the back seat and lay you down, I guess.
Can we talk about nonsensical movie plots?
Sure.
I want to talk a little bit about Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Okay.
I know that there's no reason for me to bring it up here, but I want to bring it up. Do you remember the film? You remember the film, right? So
yes, but I didn't really watch the whole thing.
So there's like four kids. Christina Applegate's the oldest one. She's like 18. And these parents go away for an entire fucking summer. An entire summer and leave their four kids with this 90-year-old woman who's near death, who they've never met. They go away.
Oh, that was the babysitter who's dead.
Yeah, she dies like almost immediately.
I never saw this film. Go ahead.
It's a great movie. It's really good. She dies almost immediately. And then they go like weeks go by. And Christina Applegate has to get a job and like take care of all the finances and everything like that. The parents never talk to the babysitter. They don't think it's weird that they talk to the babysitter zero times in like a month. How does this happen, JD? Am I the only one that's bothered by this stuff?
Well, it's kind of like the Goonies. I found the same thing a little bit ridiculous. I guess that only took place in one day as opposed to 4 months.
Yeah, months, like the whole friggin' summer. And then the mom comes home and like breaks the whole party up and then has the nerve to be mad at the daughter who made the house better, cleaned up the pool. She did better than the parents did. And you motherfucker left your kids for a whole summer. You should be thrown in jail. Man. I'm sorry. I'm a little upset about this.
I would love to leave my kids for a whole summer.
Right. Sorry, guys. We'll see you. Yeah. This old crank is going to watch you for a few months.
This rag.
By the way, we just found on Craigslist or something.
Yeah,
can you imagine that?
Yeah. This cotton top. But all right. So let's touch on a few things here before we move on. Yes, it's an absolutely embarrassing song. There's some loud synthesizers, some phony ass brass going on. It's like they took... like Jimmy Jam and Quincy Jones put them into a blender and poured it out. You had to drink it and listen to this kind of thing. But I do think that this was a number one song. I do think this is a bad number one to me musically. I see its place in terms of 80s, and I get that. I looked for a little confirmation bias here, D-Pro, so I did search that out. Like, do people find this bad or embarrassing? Because I didn't feel it was that bad or embarrassing. Turns out, this song plays first in a worst of the 80s poll, beating out We Built the City and Hanging Tough.
There's absolutely no way that I believe that.
I agree.
Yeah.
It did, but I do...
I want to meet the people who voted. I want to meet the people who voted.
It's not that terrible.
No.
That said, where do you rate it on the embarrassment scale? 1 to 10? Are you're walking out to, hey, you! Get into my trunk!
I don't think we're going to agree on this. I gave it a 4. I did not rate it that high.
Yeah, I would put it maybe like a 6er.
Yeah, I could see that being the case.
I feel like it's a hedge.
It is, and I rate it a little lower just because it just makes me happy. It's the type of song that just it has a good feel. It brings back good memories, and I feel like it's colored my opinion a little bit in that way.
Yeah.
It's probably about a 5 or a 6. You're probably right.
Hey, if you made it this far, feel free to punch out now. What are you doing here? Why?
Ironic that we're ending with this song. It's about starting something.
Morning train. You're about to lay down in front of that train.
I'll go
listen
with
to this podcast. It's Sheena Easton.
I wake up every morning, I stumble out of bed, I stretch it in the morning.
Oh boy, our buddy Max, he put Morning Train by Sheena Easton forth. He loves this song because he commutes to New York City, so he relates to the grind that she laid out in this track.
I want to talk about our friend Max here. I want to use this space to address Max.
Oh, he's like salt of the earth.
Max is one of the greatest guys I've ever met.
Factually correct.
When my dog died, he texted me and said he felt really bad and said his thoughts and prayers with my family. Right. At the same time, there is a behavior that Max frequents that I want to discuss right here in this space.
Go ahead. You have the floor.
Max's Twitter behavior. Max, come back to us, okay? He will randomly tweet at NBA teams in the middle of a game saying, "Nice rebounding at Pelicans." Ha, 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 ha. Nice win at Lakers. Not just like Max tweets like a person holding up a sign at an arena. Like, but what are you looking to get out of this engagement with the social media manager? Like, what are you thinking?
Yeah,
coming out of that?
I don't think Zion Williamson is checking his Twitter account while he's crashing the boards in the first quarter.
I would love for Max's tweets to be read to the team after a loss.
Hey guys. Look, I'm gonna take a time out here and discuss what we're seeing on social media and how we can fix it.
The coach is holding up an iPad. Aww. Seems to be on X right now. What's going on there?
God, I love Max. But Max is like a Metallica fan, a classic rock fan. But this song, he likes the beat and the music, and it puts a smile on his face. Who can deny that?
It's very much of its time.
Oh,
and very dated. It makes me, I think Max himself said that. It reminds me of that Seinfeld episode where like Kramer actually gets a job. And it's hard to be in a bad mood when you hear this song. Mm. But it's, no doubt embarrassing. Like 100% he should be embarrassed to like this song.
Speaking of Seinfeld, are you caught up to Curb yet? You even start Curb yet? This season?
I'm waiting, and then like I'm just gonna plow through it all in one shot. Okay. I still haven't. I'm still resisting. I know I have to get Max back. Speaking of Max, it's on Max.
They're cracking down on passwords. They're holding people accountable for sharing passwords.
Yeah,
so a buddy, you got to get it for you at this point.
A buddy of mine logged into mine, and I had it up for a while, and now like it's over.
Yeah,
party's over. I gotta get that my off. Own. So I definitely got to catch up. But JD, I got to tell you, this song is a song that my father used to add fake lyrics to and made fun of me as a kid.
Oh, really? What did he say?
He used to be like, "Joe Jr. takes the morning train. He tries to kiss the girls, and then they sure don't kiss them." I fucked the whole thing up.
Totally bombed. Like, you just completely. Let's take a timeout. Take a breath. You just completely bombed.
Big time.
In front of three people who are still listening.
Oh my God. Oh, I'm going to sing it again.
Go ahead.
Joe Jr. takes the morning train. He tries to kiss the girls, and then they sure don't let him kiss them. That was it.
Burn. Wow.
That's the type of stuff my dad would do.
But that's dad jokes right there. 101.
But they were hurtful. I still remember that stuff. He did the same thing with Joe Jackson's, like, stepping out. He'd be like, "You are a jerk. You are so fresh." I'm like, come on, Dad.
I didn't do anything wrong. My son is a joke.
Just because I didn't get laid in the fifth grade, like, all of a sudden, I'm this big joke.
Thank you to all of our friends for contributing some songs that you find embarrassing, putting yourself out there. Oh, before we do that.
We got to rate this.
This is a tenor for me. Walking out to this in a...
I'm between a 9 and a 10, but I can be convinced. It won't take much arm pulling, and,
this
for sure.
This is a tenor for me to walk out to. But some of our friends did put forth songs that we do find embarrassing. Mbop, Stars Are Blind, Call Me Maybe. These are songs that we've covered on this show.
Yep.
That I would have loved to include in this list.
Yeah.
But we talk about them in the past. So thank you, Joanne, Kathy, George, for those submissions.
Well, you know what, JD? It's nice to know that, you know, we're not the only cornballs who still love these cheesy-ass songs. You know, the Hugh Grant character in Music and Lyrics, this is a fitting way to end this episode. He said something. He said something really
embarrassing,
poignant about this type of music. I would read the exact quote, but my initial Google search didn't yield anything, so I gave up. But he said something to the effect of, "I got the losing horn. I got the losing horn." He basically said, "You know what? Nothing will make you feel as good as a 3-minute pop song will. It's like magic.
Oh.
What it does to your body, and it's really true." I hope I came close to capturing the spirit of what the quote is, but dude, and nothing, you know what else makes your body feel great?
Yeah, sitting across from your
being
best
here
friend.
With you.
There
sitting
we
here
go.
With your best friend. You know I'm going there, JD.
There we go. A little
always
pandering.
Great to be I here with
it.
You, but I'm going to pander to you if nothing else.
Yeah, but you got 3 kids and, you know, you suck. Yeah,
we don't have time.
You
we
suck.
Don't we don't really have time to do this. I'll see you again in another 7 months, everybody. Thanks for being here with us and see you next time on The Perfect Playlist.
They call that a comedy callback, kids.